I'm Adrian. I'm an alcoholic. Oh, no one mentioned gymnasium. So I went to something called Soberilla a couple Friday nights ago. And the only reason I went is because my sponsor makes me go to 6 meetings a week. And it was Friday, and I was 3 meetings short. So I remember sitting at Old School Group and seeing the Soberilla goes from 6 to 9. And in my mind, I'm like, that's 3 hours, that's 3 meetings. So, because everything's still a negotiation to me. So I called up the sponsor, and because I don't want to lose this one because I've been fired twice before her. So I called up, and I asked her if I could go to Soberilla if it would count for my 6. And I think this lady looks at the phone when I call every morning at 7:30 and prays I don't call back. So I went to Soberilla, and I heard something there. I've been around for quite a long time. I heard something there that really stuck with me. And the speaker said, he's like one of those Joe and Charlie big book thumpers, which is how I was raised when I was young. And now I'm old and middle age, just in case you didn't know. So he said, there's a woman who walks in the room, and she has a Louis Vuitton bag, and she sits in the back, and it's her very first meeting. So what do we do at Alcoholics Anonymous? We try to one-up ourselves and start like this. Well, I had a DUI, and the next person goes, well, I had 2 DUIs and went to jail and shot my mother. And then later on it goes down to, I put all these people in a body bags, and then I ran people. And we do the one-upmanship in AA, like my story is going to be so much worse than yours. And what value is it to the woman who came in and all she wants to do is leave after that hour and not have a drink of alcohol? I mean, most of the time, he says, they run out of the room and think, I am not that fucking bad. Sorry, my language. Sorry. And, you know, we literally do no service to people when we scare them out of the rooms. Because I relate to loneliness. I relate to living in Chicago, being, I can just picture it in Boys Town. I am 22 years old out of college. There's 100 people in the bar. I have a posse of about 20 people in the city. And I feel like I am the only person in the room. You talk about that in a meeting, and I want to come back because I want to know, how did you stop being so lonely? So that really affected me because I realized, I think sometimes, especially talking in front of young people, I think, well, I don't really do drugs. I didn't do drugs. I don't have like a really, you know, I didn't shoot heroin and get found with a needle in my arm and nothing like really dramatic. But none of that really matters. You know, what matters is, how can I help another person to be of service so they don't have to leave here in 1 hour and have a drink? That's why I'm here. So I know we have to qualify, but I, you know, we all know how to drink. So really, I don't need to tell you how I drank because we all know how to do that. That's why we're here. My problem is I didn't know how to stay stopped. But I'm from Chicago. I have 2 older brothers who I started drinking with pretty young. We had wine at dinner because my grandmother was from Czechoslovakia. So in the old country, they believe that it cures all illnesses. So we had wine with dinner sometimes, like little drinks. And I started drinking to the point of blackouts from the beginning at a very young age. I remember like being 13 years old and being out drinking and passing out and not coming home at night. And that's pretty early not to come home at that young age. And I remember once I went to like a school dance as a freshman in high school. My high school had like 4,000 people. It was enormous. And I remember leaving someone's house in the morning. I used to always wake up in early morning and walking down the street to go home. And my dad was walking to the train station because people in my village in the North Shore took the train to work. And I passed my dad walking down the street coming home. And I remember the absolute demoralizing shame that I felt, and how many years I didn't look at my parents in the eyes because I was so ashamed of how I lived. And I wanted to read something kind of about at the beginning of the book, because the textbook for me is really, I hear a lot in the rooms, like 90 and 90 and don't date in your first year and all this bullshit, and I don't find that in my textbook. So I don't know what course those people are taking, but it's not the Alcoholics Anonymous I met. Because where I grew up, where I ended up getting sober because of not being able to leave the state in Kentucky, we actually used the book at our meetings, and that's kind of what we gave advice from our experience, Strength and Hope, in the book. So what I wanted to read was from the doctor's opinion, because this kind of explains myself, just like you. It says, men and women drank excessively because they wanted the effect produced by alcohol. The sensation is so elusive that while they admit it is injurious, they cannot after time differentiate the true from the false. To them, the alcoholic life seems the only normal one. And to me, coming home early in the morning, being a young girl, was the normal one. And going up to my room on the second floor and just being like scared to death of what was going to happen. And what ended up happening was a week before my 17th birthday, obviously there was a lot of nights in between there, I was at a bar in the south side of Chicago. I'm from the North Shore of Chicago, and I had picked up three gentlemen that were African-American, and we're going to take them home to the projects, which was just right around the corner from me. So, and I had two friends of mine in the car, and what ended up happening is I went to get out of the way of a barricade, and I ended up plowing into a whole bunch of cars on the south side of Chicago. And people all ran out from their homes, and I begged people to call the police because I was afraid what was going to happen to me. And so the police came, and my dad got called, and he drove down and picked up one of my brothers who was at Northwestern in Chicago and close to the city. And they took me to jail, and they asked me to write a statement. And I ended up writing, Adrienne is a very bad girl. And that statement stays with me today because there's something in me, and I think it's part of my alcoholism with the self-hatred, that I still think I'm a bad person, even though I don't do bad things. It's that thing that we will always have to live with of just, you know, self-hatred. And I think that's been one of my biggest Achilles heels my entire life, is I walk into a room and I'm like, oh, these people hate me. It's like they're not thinking about me. They're thinking about, you know, their grocery list. I'm not that important. But after the court date, one of the girls in the car had a head injury prior and re-injured her head. And the other one went into a building in the projects and something happened to her and she stayed in her house for a month after that and wasn't in high school. And what happened to me was I went to the student drug and alcohol counselor because my high school was so huge and it was in a very affluent neighborhood. And so there was a lot of cocaine, drugs, alcohol. And I went to the counselor there at my school and I said to her, I'm an alcoholic. I had known it since I was 12 years old. But this DUI somehow really affected me, and I need to get help. And she called my dad, and they decided they were going to take me to an outpatient program that afternoon. And my dad didn't want me to go inpatient, even though at that age of 17, I would have very well qualified for an inpatient program because of my physical symptoms. But he was afraid that it would get on my permanent record, and I might be in politics or have an important career one day. So I went to this outpatient program, and after being there for 3 days, you know what happens. I thought, you know, maybe I was a little hasty. I don't think I really want to not drink. because that, you know, we rebuild, our ego rebuilds. And I, you know, after the DUI and the cops and being thrown in jail, prostitutes and all that, you were feeling kind of low. But I think it was like a pump, and I like pump myself back up. And then I didn't want to be in the treatment center anymore. So I told my parents this. And Eleanor, my mother, met at the treatment center, and she said to my dad, if she doesn't stay in this program, I'm leaving. So my parents lived with my alcoholism every day, to the point of people would ring their doorbell at 1 o'clock in the morning, and then a car door would open, and they would literally throw me out. And sometimes they would have to come out and clean vomit in people's cars before I went to this treatment center. And they had a routine where they would take me upstairs and turn me in a bathroom so I didn't choke on my own vomit. That's how my alcoholism was for years. And I used to think for a long time, like, what was wrong with my parents that they didn't say, like, this shit's got to stop. And years later, the first time I came into the rooms at 23, about 6 months I tried to go home for Christmas, even though my first sponsor, Scary Carrie, told me not to. And I only made it 24 hours and had to get in the car and leave. And I heard the truth, not my alcoholic truth that I see through a bottle, but the truth is that they didn't do anything about my alcoholism because, first of all, most parents aren't equipped to have a young child that's an alcoholic in their home. But they were very afraid that if they tried to do anything, that I would run away. And I had no concept of reality because of the lifestyle I led, and that something would happen to me and I would go to the city to live, and it would be terrible what would happen to me. So they chose not to say anything. And I think it's very painful. I'm not close with my mother. We've never really clicked. She wanted a ballerina as a daughter. I didn't do well in ballet classes. But I know I'm not a parent, but I know they waited up many nights for a car to pull up, for somebody to throw me out of the car to see if I was still alive. So I stayed in that treatment center for 6 months. We used to have to like pee in stalls, and they would watch us. And I had relapsed once. But I think the worst thing of all is to know that you're going to drink again and to be sitting in basically a 12-step room or anywhere when you know you're not done. Because it's almost just like a lie. It's like that dishonesty that we can't have. So I was waiting and waiting and waiting in these rooms for something to happen that I could get out of this treatment center. And we had gone on, in the summer, they have Outward Bound programs that people go on, like kayaking and all that fun stuff. Well, they also have a program for juvenile delinquents. And because of my criminal problems at the time, I had to go with this treatment center to Carbondale, Illinois, to the forest. We were allowed to bring 2 pair of underwear and like two shorts for like 2 weeks. And we had to hike during the day, 10 miles a day. And then at night, we would have our meeting, our hour meeting around the campfire. And that was hell for me. And we used to get like strip shirts and stuff. I was in a group with like pretty bad kids. And we went on the camping trip. You know, of course, they went through all of our bags and everything, because I was with people that were really supposed to be in jail, but they were juveniles. And I had, this is so 80s, okay, but I had a big thing of Jean Nite bash splash, because I knew we weren't going to be able to take showers, right? But, you know, there's alcohol in it. So I was very surprised, because the counselors, like, went through all my stuff, you know, in front of everybody, and they let me keep this Jean Nite. So I was like, hot damn, I'm going to smell good. So, because I have to be different than the other common folk that were in my group. So we get out there into the forest preserves. And the next morning, we sleep on the ground in sleeping bags. And the next morning, I put this Jean Nite on in the middle of the forest. And it was like, you know, bitten to death all day long with bugs. Because I'm the only one with this smell on. And the only reason I tell this story is because this is how I've learned in Alcoholics Anonymous. It has not been pretty. I've had to be bit, fallen on the ground, bloody, beat up. Sponsor can say, don't put your hand on the fire. It's going to burn you. I got to touch it. And then when I have third-degree burns, I'm like, I think I'm done with that. So that's how it's been for me in the beginning. And so finally my ticket came. It was October. I was a senior in high school. And it started at the beginning of the month. My grandmother, who had lived with me since I was 3, passed away. And that kind of took the attention off my treatment program. And then in the middle of October, near the end of the month of my senior year in high school, I thought I was sober. But I found out, because I'm so shady because of all my drinking at such an early age, that on Halloween of my senior in high school, 1987, my oldest brother, Tom, was a senior at Northwestern in Chicago, and he had been studying for midterms at the library, and he left the library to cross the street to go to his apartment, and a drunk driver on a motorcycle ran him over. Going about 70 miles an hour. And the motorcyclist was also a senior at Northwestern. He was my father's fraternity, ATO, and he was a senior president of the rugby club. And he had a helmet on, and he was dead on impact. And when they did the autopsy, he was one of us. They could tell by the drugs and alcohol in his system for the last 30 days that he would have been a member of Alcoholics Anonymous if he had lived. And my brother was in a coma for 3 months, and they weren't sure if he was going to live for a very long time. And during that period, and I relate so much to alcohol, to when they talk about the real alcoholic, because I've met people in the rooms that are heavy drinkers, And my father maybe could have been called a heavy drinker, because if there's reason enough, they can stop. And he did not drink after my brother was run over by a drunk driver for 18 years. But I am an alcoholic, and I don't have that choice not to drink without a program and the 12 Steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I got out of the treatment center because my dad called the head counselor and said that with my brother being in a coma, we had enough to deal with, so that I wasn't going to be coming back. And I hate to say it, but at the time, I really felt like I had won the lottery, because we are so self-centered that all I care about is me. And I finally got the spotlight off me. So I went to my brother's apartment, and I opened his cabinets and his refrigerator, and he had no food. And when the 24 hours before I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, my first time, July 14th, 1992, my mother had gotten me out of jail and went to my apartment where I was living in Louisville, and I had no food in my cupboards and no food in my refrigerator. And the only things that were in there were alcohol, and my trash can was filled with Jim Beam, Jack Daniels, and beer. So I drank at my brother's apartment, and our lives went back to a very abnormal state. I don't know if any parent's reaction to a child being run over by a drunk driver what normal is, but the next night was Halloween, and my mother gave out Halloween candy to people that came in the door like nothing was wrong, and it was eerie. And that's kind of how our pattern was. Even when I used to like wreck cars and stuff, we would pretend like nothing happened. It's very strange. So from then, I went along and graduated from high school and went off to college. Even though I had been admitted alcoholic, I drank openly in front of my family, went out every night, was a serious alcoholic in college every day. My sophomore year, I got like a 4.0 in three semesters, because I got a 1.3, a 0.7, and an A 2.0. So I remember coming home the end of my sophomore year. I was still a pledge in my sorority, because you had to get a 2.3. So I lived in my sorority house as a junior and wore a pledge shirt on Mondays, because I couldn't get a 2.3. And I remember coming home to my dad my junior year, because every once in a while it would come back over me that I'm an alcoholic and I need help, like on a daily basis. But sometimes I would say it out loud to another person. I came home my junior year from college, and I said to my dad, sophomore year, I said, you know, I really don't think I should go back to the school. It's like, you know, it's a private college. It's like, I don't even know, $25,000 a year. And I got a 4.0 in three semesters. Like, you know what I mean? I got a 1.3, and my drinking's really getting bad. And he basically said, you have to go back, because getting your graduating from college is very important. And you can't transfer schools, because that looks like something's wrong, and you're going back. And it's weird. It's a mixed bag for me. I'm grateful that I did get my degree. Not that anyone's ever asked what my GPA was or what I graduated with, because really nobody cares. But he did push me to do that. And my senior year, I had a difficult time reading and writing, especially when I came in the program. I could read the same page of the Big Book for a year and not remember it. And my dad wrote my senior thesis and sent it to me FedEx at college, because I found out to graduate you had to write 48 pages. And everyone knew, like, what an alcoholic I was. So he wrote it, and then I found out you had to, like, present it to a whole panel of people. And I was like, motherfucker, like, how am I going to do that? Because every teacher at this school knew I was a raging party girl alcoholic who was disappeared for long periods of time and was only there because I paid full tuition and all that. So So anyways, I graduated from that private school because literally I don't even think I had enough credits, but the dean, I'd been on social probation, academic probation. I was in trouble with the court systems in that state. So literally he was like, yes, you have enough credits. Mom, I know they didn't add up, and they graduated me just to get me out of there. And I went back to Chicago for a while, and to make a long story short, I had a spiritual awakening and didn't know what they were. Because we didn't really, we weren't religious people at all. It's very strange, but we kind of like went to Christmas Eve Mass, kind of drinking, and would sing like the wrong Christmas carols and would be up in the balcony like making a scene. So I wasn't really a religious person, so I didn't have that against me when I came in. But I had gone on this trip alone, and I was driving back from Florida to go home to Chicago, and the sun was rising, and I'd been on a binge for 7 days, and something came over me, and it said, if you move to Louisville, your life will change. It was the weirdest thing. And I went back to Chicago and literally said to my parents, I have to move to Louisville. Now, I had sorority sisters from college there, but I never really thought people would leave the city of Chicago and move to Kentucky. So I was like, I have to do this. I don't know why, but I just have to do this. I told my boss, everybody. And you would think my parents, with them being the only daughter, would be like, oh, please don't go. My dad was like, we will pay for your apartment. And he actually rented a moving truck to get my shit out of their house and down the road. So I get to Louisville, and like everything's going to be different there. Because, like, Chicago, I was a big party girl and all that. And in college in Ohio, and, you know, my high school, like, everywhere I went. But when I went to Kentucky, like, Louisville is going to be totally different. And because there's, like, horses there and white picket fences, and I'm going to, like, settle down, even though I know I'm gay, but I'm going to, like, meet a man, and, like, he's going to take care of me. Like, all this crazy shit. So I get to Louisville, and I go to the Kentucky Derby, right? Like, it's the first weekend in May, and I get arrested June 2nd. Okay, so when I'm getting arrested at 5 o'clock in the morning in Louisville, they're like, what are you doing here with an Illinois license plate and a Chicago driver's license and all that? And I'm like, I'm here for the Kentucky Derby. And it's like right when I said that, praise God, 15 minutes. Right when I said that, I knew I was going to jail because it was a month ago, the Derby. So I actually blew a .28, and I really didn't feel drunk at all because that was my pretty much maintenance because I had been drinking for so many years. And that's not to impress people and scare the woman with the Gucci bag out of the meetings. But .28 for me was pretty normal, so I walked a straight line, and they were like, wow, you must drink a lot. Because I talked to them like, oh, this is my dad's business car, and here's the registration, and everything totally fine, .28. And they told me I couldn't go before the judge until I could get below a .1. I was thinking, my God, that could take days. I could be in jail for days. So when they arrested me, I had this AAA bond card that we used in Chicago, so I didn't have to stay in jail. And for some reason, like in every other court that I went to jails, they always accepted this bond card, so I didn't have to bother my parents during the night, and they would bond me out of jail. This is not normal. I found out later on when I grew up and found out the rest of the world works and doesn't have stuff like this. So I told the Kentucky people, like, I don't go to jail because I have this bond card. And so I went to jail with these 15 girls that they chained me to. And I called my mother, Eleanor, and said, like, you need to MF come get me these people for all that. And I didn't know that my brother, who had been robbed by a drunk driver, was in ICU and had gotten really, really sick. Because my parents never talked about that because they thought I wasn't strong enough